Major Crane calling.
Good day, everyone. My name is Brian Bonner, and I'm very happy to be here and to introduce the relaunch of Hromadske Radio's Ukraine Calling program. Let me first say, introduce myself a little more. This is a new role for me, but I've been in Ukraine for a long time, coming and going for 28 years. Probably best known as the longtime chief editor of the Kyiv Post, which is Ukraine's English language newspaper from 2008 to 2021, but I've also had other roles in election observation, public health advocate. We will come to you weekly or even more often if we can to bring you interviews with top newsmakers and just plain interesting people in English to talk about the big stories facing Ukraine and their big contributions to this great country. The studio is nicely refurbished now, and I'm very happy about that. And we are going to launch the first episode with an interview I had with Marta Dichok, who was the founding host of Ukraine Calling. And I also want to tell you where you can listen and view us. You can tune into Ukraine Calling on Hromadske Radio's website, on our dedicated YouTube channel, and also Spotify, Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Amazon Podcasts. Thank you for watching and listening. I am not a difficult person to find on social media, so if you have comments or want to suggest any guests to be in the studio, please do that. We are centrally located on Krishatik Street, Ukraine's main street, in this perilous time for Ukraine of war. What is the mood of Ukrainians who are paying attention to what's going on?
The Europeans are really waking up, and the Americans and Canadians are not. It seems to me that a small group of white men are in a position to really fundamentally change what's going on.
I never really understood why Canada has always been so reluctant to spend much on its defense budget. Nobody's going to touch us because we're neighbors.
History has shown us that the only way that you prevent authoritarian expansionist powers and leaders is by force. That's what they understand. If Ukraine had received the military aid that it had requested, the war would be over.
I am so happy that I have Dr. Marta Dichok, Associate Professor, International Politics and History. She specializes in at Western University in London, Ontario. We've been friends for more than a decade.
Many, many years.
Sure. Germane to the program, she is the original founder and the original host of Ukraine Calling. She produced 124 episodes from 2016 to 2019. Very impressive array of guests, topics, formats, and everything. And that's what I want to go over with her today. And she didn't just do the program. She wrote a book about it. And here it is. It's one of her books. I only have the digital version. Maybe Marta will send me an autographed copy of the print version. It's really great. I haven't listened to every episode. After Marta left, there were another 28 episodes. And then with COVID and the war, the program sort of went dormant, but Marta would not let it die. And she reached out to me, and I was able to work with Andrei Kulikov and Kirilo Lukarenko, the executive director. And we got together enough grants to put together a team to relaunch this. And this is what we're going to do now in a newly remodeled studio. So that's a long introduction to say, welcome, Marta. How are you?
Ryan, I am so happy to be here, and I'm delighted to see Hromadske Radio's Ukraine Calling reborn in a new way, and that you're hosting it. So I'm just delighted to see this happening.
I'm just curious to go back sort of in memory lane, why you started it. I read the book, and you said, well, all my friends kept asking me in Canada what's going on in Ukraine, because there were too few English language sources. Apparently, the Kyiv Post wasn't enough for them. Maybe you can elaborate more on what really got, beyond that, what got you going, and whether, since 2016, there's been a lot of technology changes. Do you think we still need Ukraine Calling, and why?
A lot has changed, but a lot has not changed. And I first got into journalism when I was a PhD student at Oxford a long time ago. And the news coming about Ukraine, this was still 1991, there was almost no news about Ukraine because all the media outlets, they had their bureaus in Moscow. So I was doing my PhD. I went to Kyiv to do research, and I reached out to The Guardian and said, do you need me to write something about Ukraine? And they said, sure, We'd love to have somebody on the ground. And then in 2016, well, 2014 is when things got interesting with the Euromaidan protests. The world started paying attention. And again, my friends and colleagues were saying, what's going on? Explain. Because there was not enough consistent English language news. Things would appear in Canadian and international media when there was a heightened story. But to sort of follow along on a regular basis, Kyiv Post was one of the only, but not everybody reads newspapers. Podcasts had become the thing. And I thought, well, let's do a podcast. And Gromadske Radio was set up by these amazing people, and some of them were my friends. So I reached out to Andriy Kulikov, who was then the head of the radio station. Kirill Lukyanenko was the main news editor. And they said, yeah, that would be great. And so I just started every week so that it was consistent, so that it wasn't just when, you know, a big story launched, but so the people who wanted to stay on top of Ukraine. And since 2022, there's been an explosion of information about Ukraine. But I believe that Hromadske Radio is unique in that it provides a very different perspective than the other media outlets that are there, because it focuses both on the big stories, but also on the little stories. And this is what I think the new Five Ukraine Calling podcast can really do. That could be the niche that President Zelensky gives interviews. So it'd be great to have him on. But some of the things that I think are really poignant that are not reaching international audiences enough are things like something that appeared on Hromadske Radio's English language feed on Twitter about a journalist from Kherson who chose to stay under occupied conditions and continue to report. And that sort of a story, I think, is not making it out, because the big stories more or less are covered, but it's the micro stories. And Andriy Kulikov just did a few series about international attention to missing people. And again, that's the sort of story that's not making it into the big international headlines, but I think are really, really important for international audiences to see the full picture and the big picture.
That's good. Do you think that Canadians would be interested, or what do you think Canadians are interested in?
I think the challenge now, 2+ years into the war, is to keep the story in people's attention, as you know. Because, you know, the war, it's just the same sort of reporting of more shelling or attacks on civilian targets. That story has been told many times. It needs to continue being told. But I think the challenge is to how to make it interesting. And I recently, just earlier this week, I screened that really good documentary, 20 Days in Mariupol, at my university. And that was really powerful. And people came up and said, wow, that's really stayed with me. What can we do? So that sort of thing of reaching out in a way that is not the headlines. But, you know, human interest stories is one thing. But also there's a lot of talk about Ukrainian resilience. But to fill that out a little more, again, I came across a story about this big bookstore that just opened in Kyiv. I think that would be a fascinating thing for Canadian audiences to see, that Ukrainians, they're not just making drones and chasing Russians away, but they're also opening bookstores and reading and holding book events. So I think to sort of diversify the picture.
That is a great point, and you're very good at picking out those stories. You're right. I was, you know, at the Kyiv Post in 2014, Ukraine was the hot story. By 2016, international interest had cooled off quite a bit. We even ran a promo saying, you know, all the big time journalists have left. Kyiv Post remains. We're not going anywhere. And I think that's why Internews Network, which is like media support arm of the U.S. government, decided to invest in Ukraine Calling, because I think we all recognize that Ukraine is sort of falling again out of the focus of world to global attention, and certainly focusing or falling off in terms of the support that it is getting as this war, unfortunately, it goes into the third year.
Something else I think Ukraine Calling could really do that would be unique and really useful is to engage in conversations with Western journalists who parachute into Ukraine. A lot of journalists, they don't live in Ukraine, so they don't know the story. Something happens, they parachute in and they leave. But people like you and other Ukrainian journalists have a role to play in informing them about the bigger story. So to engage with them in conversations on air, I think would be fascinating.
Your favorite episode you wrote was, I believe, the original Canadian ambassador to Ukraine. And your show had a Canadian flavor, obviously.
I'm Canadian, of course.
Yes.
This type of a podcast is multidimensional. So it covers the headlines, but it also fills in a lot of things that are behind the headlines. And the reason I really enjoyed that interview, that was with the Honorable Nestor Gajewski, who was Canada's chargé d'affaires, the first Canadian diplomat posted in Ukraine. I met him at the time, and we maintained a friendship after his retirement. But it was only during that interview that I learned the full story of how Canada became the first Western country to recognize Ukraine's independence. And he told me the story in great detail about how then Foreign Minister Barbara MacDougall traveled to Ukraine with this then satellite telephone because communications had to be protected, and how she left the phone and how he then used it to contact Ottawa after Ukraine declared it. So it was sort of like a little, not spy thriller, but you got an insight into what had happened. And then Roman Verstruck, who later became Canada's ambassador to Ukraine at the time, was political officer in Ottawa. So he had a role to play. So it was like all these pieces came together in this podcast. And I keep reminding Nestor to publish his memoirs. He's been working on his memoirs, but they're not quite ready. But anyway, we got a little snippet of history told by somebody who was instrumental in making history. So I love those sorts of stories.
Maybe you can coach people on memoir writing. I'm trying to write mine from my experience at the Kyiv Post. And it's not going very quickly. And I'm in touch with U.S. Ambassador John Teft, the former ambassador. He's been working on his memoirs for years. There's an art to it because I believe you published, I don't know, how many books? 5, 10?
7. Quick piece of advice on writing memoirs. The easiest thing is find somebody to talk to and record it and then transcribe it.
So there's a time benefit thing. That is another great tip. And we're only a few minutes into this conversation. Well, I probably need to step out of being selfishly tapping you for your wisdom, but remind me again of how you trace your Ukrainian roots.
Oh, well, my parents were World War II refugees. They came to Canada on separate routes, met in Toronto, fell in love, and got married. The reason I keep crying is because they lived through this horrific war back in, World War II. And here we are again, and we're seeing the same thing, people being displaced and family members being killed, families being torn apart, homes destroyed. And it's just, that phrase, never again, we're living through again. And we're watching a genocide be perpetrated in real time. Sad that my parents are no longer with us, but I'm very happy they're not watching this because it would just break their hearts.
Do you think I should resurrect the Ukrainian music? How hard is that to find every week, week after week?
That was a very popular feature of the show. And I found it really easy. I enjoyed doing that part because I follow contemporary music. And I think I had one or two musicians on. There's no lack of Ukrainian musicians who have very interesting stories to tell. And they're producing music all the time. So finding it is easy. It's a way to either introduce or end the show. And I think it also adds the sort of the texture that Ukrainians are both fighting on the front line, but also fighting on the cultural front. Andriy Kulikov can help you with that. I can help you with that. There's tons of concerts in Ukraine, in Kyiv all the time. There are musicians who perform internationally. I mean, I go to all the shows that come to Canada. There have been many tours. So I you're not going to have any problem finding really good contemporary Ukrainian music.
I wanted to ask what you're working on now. I mean, besides teaching, is your bio current that you're working on research about how media in Ukraine has changed? Is that still or is that published already?
Well, that's the big topic. What I'm focusing on now is my new research project looks at the relationship between war and social media. And I just started that project. So I've just started collecting the data. And it's going to be a big project. So it's going to be a number of years. I also have a book coming out called Ukraine, Not the Ukraine. And that's a history book. It's a short little book for people who are interested in Ukraine, but don't have time to read a big fat history book. So this is like a whirlwind tour from the medieval prince Volodymyr the Great through rock star president Volodymyr Zelensky. And it goes through the Kievan Rus period, the Cossacks, the nation building, the state building, and of course the war. So that should be coming out shortly.
Ukraine history for dummies or the Cliff Notes. you're putting all of the rest of us to shame who claim that we're writers because you actually are doing it and publishing it. So congratulations, and we'll look forward to that project. When are you coming back to Ukraine, by the way?
Hopefully in the summer to collect some more data.
It's hard to get in and out, but obviously love to see you and have you on the program when you come back. The mood in Canada about the war, is it as glum as it feels here in Kyiv? Because people are very worried about Ukrainian aid. Quite disappointed that, you know, Ukrainians have to be careful because they're getting how they express their disappointment because they're depending on, you know, the Western allies to come through for them. But I guess as an American, I'll put a sharper edge to it. I'll take your Justin Trudeau as an example, who said that Canada would give as much as it takes for as long as it takes, but neither element seems to be holding up well. What is the mood of Canadians, Ukrainians who are paying attention to what's going on?
Well, that's an excellent question. And I'm going to start by saying I feel that it's my responsibility to comment on that sort of thing. And my comment has consistently been Canada could and should be doing more. And I said that in a CBC interview last Friday when I was interviewed about, you know, 2 years of war, where are we at? Canada is diplomatically supporting Ukraine. So all the statements are spot on. But in terms of actual humanitarian, military, economic aid, in my opinion, it's falling short. And I think it's great that Trudeau went to Ukraine just recently because he has not been there very much. Just the moral support of visiting the country, I think, is really important. The mood in Canada, there are a lot of different crises, and this has been 2 years. So wars are exciting when they start, but I'm seeing the same phenomenon with the Israel-Hamas war. It's no longer the number one story, and that's just since the fall. So that's you as a journalist, you understand the news cycle, the way it works, you're following the latest. And Canadians are also facing their own challenges with economic problems and homelessness problems and various other issues that are, you know, part of our lives. So the international news is part of this, what we get every day. What is more worrying for me is what's happening, because the critique I have of Canada is we're not doing enough, but the commitment to Ukraine is still there in principle. Nobody is talking about, well, I shouldn't say that. The Conservative Party recently voted against increasing aid to Ukraine, but they are not in any position to make decisions. So the Liberals and all the other parties, the NDP, they're still very much on board with supporting Ukraine. but they should be doing more. That's the point. What I'm concerned about is what's happening in your Washington, because it seems to me that a small group of white men are in a position to really fundamentally change what's going on, because American public opinion is in favor of supporting Ukraine. Political elites on both sides are. So it's just that bottleneck. So I don't know how to get through that, but that's more your story. The Canadian public, I have to give you a mixed picture. Some people have tuned out. They're no longer interested in Ukraine. Other people are still very engaged. And just the other day, I had two people in my office and we were talking about, you know, what sort of a new fundraiser can we organize to help people in Ukraine, how to make it effective and where to target our support. And neither of them are Ukrainian. So they were just, because they know what I do. And so they were just, okay, well, what is it that we can do? And so we were brainstorming about that. People who've tuned out, but people who are still very much engaged.
Definitely my country has major dysfunctions, which are pretty prominent on the world stage now. But while we're on the subject of Canada, and I read the Globe and Mail and Toronto Star and try to keep up as much as I can because we're neighbors, I mean, Americans and Canadians. But I never really understood why Canada has always been so reluctant to spend much on its defense budget chronically. Is it because proximity to America? And you figure, I mean, psychologically, they figure, hey, nobody's going to touch us because we're neighbors with America.
That's a really good point. It's a discussion within Canada because there are those who say we really need to take responsibility and defend ourselves. And there are those, we live next door to the U.S. They'll just protect us. So that's really where the discussion sits. And we can choose to spend our money on healthcare and the Americans will build up the defense. And in case of problems, they'll defend us. And the state of the Canadian military is not great. And this is something that the Russia's war against Ukraine has revealed, that, you know, I was interviewing a former ambassador, Roman Vashchuk, for my class because I teach a course on Russia's war against Ukraine. I have 1,000 students, by the way. And he was saying that Canada has sent a lot of the military aid that it can, but it doesn't actually have that much more to send. So for Canada to send more tanks, more whatever, Canada would have to buy them somewhere. It's not like we have them sitting on a stockpile and we're not giving. So this is also a question of what is Canada's perception of defense and how much we are spending. And this whole discussion, Canada has never met its NATO commitments on spending. We are at 1.3%. We're nowhere close. Well, I mean, 2%, we've never actually spent 2%. And so that's also a discussion that is an internal Canadian discussion.
Something does happen, you're close. I'm sure America will let everybody in. Because what is the statistics that grabs my mind? Like 75% of Canadians live within 50 miles of the United States border all the way. It's truly amazing.
Canada's population distribution is very unusual. There's something called the Golden Horseshoe, which is part of Ontario and Quebec. And that's where something like 2/3 of the population of Canada lives, in that area. And that's if you sort of visualize where the Great Lakes are, you know, Toronto to Montreal, and you draw a little smile, that's called the Golden Horseshoe. That's where most of people live. And the rest are just spread out. So,
you know, as a historian, are we at a stage yet where we can draw conclusions about the mistakes made and what's gone wrong? I mean, I'm not sure how it's going to hold up over history, but it does seem clear that the West made huge mistakes from the beginning by sort of dribbling out weapon systems rather than giving Ukraine everything in the first years, or in the first year of the war, and actually before. And at what point do you see that, hey, I have a historical theme to follow? Are you there yet with the war?
I don't know that we have a clear analogy. I don't think that we've seen something like this clearly in the past. The closest we have is 38-39 appeasement of Hitler. So if we give something, then he will stop. And that's sort of, you know, there's some of that sort of thinking with regards to Putin, that if we don't provoke him too much, he will stop, which is faulty thinking, because the way history has shown us that the only way that you prevent authoritarian expansionist powers and leaders is by force. That's what they understand. The thing that's different this time is the nuclear weapons. And I agree with what you've said. I think the collective West has been very timid and almost afraid. And I believe that's because of the nuclear question. Everybody is really hesitant because they're afraid that they're going to provoke a nuclear war. And Putin knows this, and he's playing with this. And he's regularly saying, I will use nuclear weapons. And then, of course, everybody gets scared and backs down, which is, I think, a weakness in Western military thinking and political strategic thinking, because, you know, that policy of mutual assured destruction hasn't disappeared, right? The reason there has been no nuclear war is because of that principle that if one country launches, the other will, and the planet blows up. So, of course, that means nobody will ever actually use, you know, I wouldn't want to be the one taking the decision to prove that wrong, which is what I think leaders in the capitals are thinking. Right. But that said, what the Europeans are really waking up, and the Americans and Canadians are not. And I think Europe has to do with proximity. And
right, Europe is going to, it has to do with American politics too.
But the countries that get it and their policies are, I believe, spot on are the countries that have been invaded by Russia in the past.
No, you would have loved to have been here on the second anniversary. We had a parade, a smorgasbord of, besides Trudeau, just a whole bunch of international leaders, strong ones, Wesley Clark and others, making the point that, you know, if we're going to let Putin's threats deter us, then there's going to be no end to them on the nuclear front. And we have, by the way, nuclear weapons too. And I don't think Putin wants to lose everything. And the other thing is about the weapons and just how Ukraine always gets it too late to be, you know, of maximum value. Tanks, aircraft, jets, things that could have been really handy in the first year are not so handy anymore.
If Ukraine had received the military aid that it had requested, the war would be over.
Well, I welcome you here. It's great seeing you. Again, and I look forward to the day I see you in person again, either here or in Canada or wherever it happens to be, at some conference or wherever we find each other.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Brian. All the best.
Ukraine Calling.
Please join us again. In our next episode, I will be interviewing retired U.S. General Ben Hodges, who was the commander of U.S. Army forces in Europe and is one of the most insightful commentators on Russia's war against Ukraine. Thanks to grants, we got to restart the program. We hope this is going to be a very popular program. We already have some fantastic guests lined up. But the first thing I need to do is to thank a lot of people. This is a huge team effort. I'm sitting here alone, but actually, there's a lot of people to thank. First and foremost, the Internews Network, which is the U.S. government's media support arm, run by Gillian McCormick, who is the chief of party for the U.S. Agency for International Development. They supply the grants for remodeling the studio, relaunching the program. Hromadsky Radio has a great team, and it's getting bigger and better all the time. So there's a long list of people to thank, and I want to do that just so you know that who are some of the people involved in making this happen. First, I'd like to thank Andrei Kulikov, who's a co-founder of Hromadsky Radio. Kirilla Lukarenko is the executive director of Hromadsky Radio. Anna More is the executive producer of Hromadsky Radio. Vlad Bundash is also a producer here. Yarel Fedorak is cameraman. Edward Dutka will be taking care of website publication and social media. Alina Shevchenko is the expert video editor. If you have comments or want to suggest any guests to be in the studio, please do that. Also, subscribe to us on all of our various social media platforms. Thank you for joining.
Ukraine Calling.